For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, state leaders are finally moving forward with a budget. After negotiations stalled earlier this week, Governor Stitt stood with leaders from the House and Senate to announce a budget deal for the coming fiscal year. Neva, how does this budget look to you?
Well, I think it's a win-win-win. I mean, when you really look at it, at the end of that long process, we found that the governor got the points that he was looking for, and the House and Senate leadership certainly held fast to the things that they wanted. There were some compromises, as there have to be, to finally get the deal done. But when you look at an $8 billion budget, I mean, this is the first time we've now crossed the $8 billion mark. It was 7.6 in this current fiscal year, but we also have the first time where we've increased Oklahoma's savings account without the law having to force it. I mean, basically, we're going to have $1 billion in savings by next year, and that's a significant point, and that was something that the governor was really intractable on. And I think the other key point is that for the first time in state history, Oklahoma teachers have gotten a pay raise for the second straight year, and this does now put us as number one in the region in teacher pay. So significant points, many other things that were kind of first time in state history on some of the funding that is in this budget. But all in all, I think this is a very bright prospect and something that Oklahomans can be proud of as they look into the details.
Ryan.
Number one, this budget would not be possible if we hadn't seen the revenue raising measures that passed last year. I mean, this is what happens whenever you give the government some money to fund things, they begin to fund things. And we also didn't see a real reversal in this legislative session of last year's revenue-raising measures and trying to cut taxes again or give away revenue. We saw a lot of investment in state services. Now, that said, even though things could have been a lot worse, I will say that we're missing a lot of opportunities here. I mean, we're putting $200 million into the Rainy Day Fund right now that already has more than $400 million in there. Of that $200 million, there are a lot of investments that we're leaving on the table. I mean, Neva's right. 2 years in a row, teacher pay raises, that's a great thing. But at the same time, per pupil funding is still well below where it was 10 years ago. Department of Corrections has huge unfunded infrastructure needs and repairs that need to happen at DOC facilities. I mean, we're seeing correctional officers getting a raise, but I mean, we could probably just call that meager at best. Criminal defense law or the public defenders and the indigent defense system still woefully underfunded. I think that they're looking at around $2 million there. But there are a lot of really critical needs. There are a lot of agencies that took 20% plus cuts over the last 10 years that didn't see any increases in appropriations. So this is, in terms of a turnaround budget, it's a good first start, right? We're beginning to see this new revenue plug in, but to say that we have, you know, turned the ship around entirely, I think, you know, really misses what's happened over the last 10 years.
But when you look at things like when you talk about education, putting an additional $74 million into the funding formula for local classroom needs, I mean, that's significant. I mean, we can't do it all in 1 year, but what we are seeing is very thoughtful, very deliberative action to move the needle in all of these areas, just like you mentioned in terms of criminal justice reform, investing in the drug courts, diversion programs, revamping how DAs and the whole structure of how they are going to have budgets. And I mean, we're seeing so many significant things happen that I think when we really get more and more into the details that we'll see in many of these agencies, while there's a lot of room that still has to be made in terms of getting where we want to see it ultimately, I think this is a strong first step. And we did it without just spending everything. I think this $200 million where we've moved it into the savings account basically for the state, that's equivalent to only 2 months operating for the state of Oklahoma. But it does begin to give us the opportunity to, in these downturns, which we will have at some point in the future, we'll be better positioned to deal with them.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up criminal justice and criminal justice reform. I mean, I mentioned corrections. Our prisons right now, county jails around the state are just a dumpster fire. I mean, they are in a state of total meltdown. Our prisons right now, the infrastructure that needs to be repaired there is just beyond critical. And, you know, I think that we've heard that from the director over and over again. But one of the other funding items, and you mentioned this briefly, Neva, was the $20 million to district attorneys to help reform the way way their budgets, the way their offices are funded by the state legislature. Right now, more than half of DA offices don't get their money from, don't get a majority of the money from their legislature. Now, I'm happy with them getting this money, but they should get this money and give up the fines and fees that they're putting on the backs of poor people.
I did want to ask about the savings account. While it's good that we're putting money into savings account, there are restrictions. There are major restrictions on getting that money out. So if we need it for something, there have to be specific reasons and abilities to get it. So it's easy to put it in. It's not so easy to get it out.
That's correct. But I think in this climate, I think that the notion of being able to put it in now and knowing that we'll be able to move forward into the next fiscal year with things being covered to the degree that that this budget covers them, I think that that was not a cause for great concern by either legislative leaders or the governor. At least it appears from this point.
I mean, if you look at state public defenders right now, they're saying that they'll probably get around $2 million in this budget. And a lot of that, I think, will likely be tied to bail reform in the event that bail reform happens at the state legislative legislature this year, which seems like there's a really good chance that we could see real substantive bail reform pass this session, that indigent defenders and public defenders have said we need more money because we're going to have to show up more at these bail hearings. Well, they're probably going to get about $2 million for that. In reality, they need about $3 to $5 million, not just to cover the increase to their cost and overhead for bail, but just their general operations. Mm-hmm. And then in the meantime, we put $19 million in the Quick Action Closing Fund, which has a really poor track record and has very little transparency and accountability. And so there's money out there, whether it's the $20 million to DAs, $19 million to the Quick Action Closing Fund. There are agencies out there and services that, a few million dollars could make or break them. And we're putting huge amounts, whether it's $200 million into the Rainy Day Fund that locks it away, or this money into the Quick Action or the Quick Action Closing Fund. If you want to know kind of really a really good breakdown, I'd look at the Oklahoma Policy Institute at OK Policy, their Twitter feed. They've got a really good thread on there that kind of goes line by line through this budget of missed opportunities.
But I think the question, and I think the point that needs to be kind of injected into this whole budget conversation is the fact that the governor and his team, the cabinet that he's put together that have been charged with a high level of oversight and looking at transparency and accountability, as well as Senator Treat and his Loft bill being put into place that will allow for more transparency and accountability, looking at the numbers, getting real numbers, having a better handle on it, really the line item. And many of these big agencies have been able to see it at a level that they've not done before. I think it will put the burden and the impetus on these folks to really be accountable when they come back next year, and these lawmakers are going to have a better look at numbers than they've ever had before.
Again, even leaving aside the substance of the budget bill, just the dynamics at play here. I mean, the executive branch, Governor Stitt, his team played a much more proactive role, it seems, in crafting this budget deal among legislators and being a partner at the table with legislators and moving key pieces of this around. And, we saw earlier
something
this week.
Something we haven't seen in
dueling press conferences. And, there was a lot of negotiation behind the scenes, and we saw some proxy fights on nominations. But a lot of that was because you have this executive branch that's weighing in a way that they haven't. And years past, it was always the Senate and the House, and the governor was just kind of, there. And now the governor's a real player and the numbers
and
that we're
looking
at
today. And
I don't
think there were very many areas that were really kind of cast aside or forsaken. Even when the Medicaid expansion conversation didn't move forward, when you look at this budget, there are a series of appropriation increases for health care programs that are very significant, things that have been kind of on the back burner that lawmakers for a number of years have been trying to advance. And this was something in these negotiations, as you say, Ryan, that the governor and Senate and House leadership were able to forge through and come up with something that some of those numbers seem small, but they're significant in terms of really kind of resetting the mark on where they want to move forward.
And we're not done yet. I mean, we could see some things that deal with budget items that aren't in this budget.
Right.
The earned income tax credit, the restoration of that, that's still a real possibility. There are other things that we could see that are ancillary to the actual budget bill.
And we still have 2 weeks left, so any of those bills could come through.
Well, maybe. I mean, they may pass this budget and knock out a handful of criminal justice reform measures and want to get out of that building. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, for
I
those
think
of
it
us,
will move fairly quickly unless there's something highly unusual that happens. I mean, most people now are saying that by the end of next week that the lawmakers probably will be going home.
I've never seen them stay come after Memorial. Only once.
They certainly don't
they
want
had to. Yeah. And only because they had to.
And they did their constitutional prerogative. The one thing that the legislature has to do is they have to get a budget and they got to get it on the governor's desk and the governor's got to sign it. That's it. Anything else that they do is icing on the cake.
That's right. Well, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs is challenging the initiative petition to send Medicaid expansion to a vote of the people. The conservative think tank filed a challenge with the state Supreme Court, calling it unconstitutional because expanding federal health benefits in Oklahoma would allow the federal government to step on the duties of state lawmakers. Ryan, does the OCPA have a case here?
I mean, it'll be interesting to see how the Supreme Court deals with this. And I think that if you think about if we were just giving total control to the federal government on Medicaid, then I think that we may have a problem. But what we're doing is we're expanding the definition of eligibility in the state of Oklahoma. And we've done that through statute for years. One of the reasons that I suspect, I don't know for sure, that the drafters of this ballot measure decided to go to the constitutional route is that they've seen in recent years that the legislature come back and try to undermine the will of the voters. If you put something in statute, through a ballot measure, the next legislative session, that legislature can come in and undo it or undo a part of it. And so they wanted to put this in the Constitution. And if you think about that, that's to me makes a lot of sense because healthcare ought to be a fundamental right, and fundamental rights ought to be in the Constitution because they remove them beyond the reach of the legislative majority for that particular time. It makes it a lot harder to touch. And so, you know, the idea that we're just changing this definition of eligibility. Yeah, you know, the federal government, they can do whatever they want in terms of funding, but we are the ones that get to decide that. And frankly, we decided and we submit that application to the federal government for a waiver because we're looking at something where we're asking the federal government to give us a waiver for a particular definition. If they don't give us that waiver, then, you know, We're back to square one.
Neva.
Well, I think it is interesting when you say that it's harder to touch, but it's also harder to pass when you try to put something in the
yeah.
Constitution.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've seen that even in recent state questions. So this is one of those clear public policy debates where there are two strong and very divergent opinions on how Medicaid expansion should go or not go. I think it will be interesting when we look at the Supreme Court. As I understand it, one justice has recused himself and we have two vacancies, so we'll have six justices that will be making this very significant ruling, and I think it will be interesting also to see if the Attorney General weighs in with an opinion on this as well, which I believe the court has invited the Attorney General's office to do. So it will be fascinating to see. And I think OCPA, in asking for the petition to be barred from the November 2020 ballot, I mean, certainly the politics of all of this is a huge factor. Mm-hmm. And I think it will be fascinating first to see what happens in the legal process, and then to see if it moves forward, how the people of Oklahoma really respond to this. Because, as I say, I think there's clearly two very, very strong points of view on this that are polar opposite. And it's something that the legislature's battled over for years. And I think it's certainly a paramount discussion that needs to have some resolution in the near future.
And not just getting it passed, but getting enough signatures. It's yeah. 178,000 signatures?
Yeah,
or something
I mean,
like that.
Well, and you're going to want to get more than that. So you're probably
sure,
looking at closer to 200,000 just. You know, to err on the side of, you know, in case you get some mm-hmm. signatures that get tossed out.
Yeah. And 90 days is
that's the real thing.
Is the real test to be able to get that done.
To make that to a year,
well,
but they've
you know,
never
that's
gone
the,
through.
That's the real hurdle. I mean, if you talk to Kent Myers, who's kind of the best election law, ballot measure, state question lawyer in the state, who has more experience in front of the Supreme Court in writing these ballot measures than anyone, and he's representing the Medicaid expansion side here. If you talk to him, the real obstacle isn't the signature requirement. It's the number of it's the time that you've got to get it in. 90 days is really hard to get that. But I feel like they can, and they're really sophisticated operations. And if you've got a well-funded organization going out and collecting these signatures, it's doable. And the thing that Medicaid expansion pulls through the roof. You know, people are excited about it, which is one of the reasons that the politics of this, you want to keep it off that November ballot because it become a referendum in some of these candidate races as well, or drive folks to the polls that may not otherwise show up, although it's a presidential presidential
at
year.
Presidential year.
There are going to be
so
people
higher
there.
Higher turnout anyway.
Higher turnout anyways. And if the Supreme Court does toss this, I think that there's still probably enough time for the ballot proponents to come back with new language, get it in front of the court, and go back out with signatures. So, yeah, well, this is a first step. You know, I think that there's a good chance that it moves forward. But even if it doesn't, they've still got plenty of time to come back and take another bite at the apple.
But it's also had lawmakers or actually leaders say, you know, Governor Stitt said, OK, I've got to give an option for people.
Yep.
And he says sometime in fall, he's going to have something for people to give them a second option instead of this.
And I think his kind of positioning going into this is significant because clearly the governor with his favorability among Oklahomans right now, I mean, he has the opportunity to put some political capital into this equation and become a real voice. So if he has something that he lays out there in the fall moving into the next legislative session that begins to get some traction, perhaps that will be the real kind of test between these two ideas of which moves forward in the minds of Oklahomans.
Well, you know, former Speaker Steve Lewis said, you know, the governor's looking at options, but there's only so many ways to expand Medicaid, and so those options are out
there. There are states out there that have done some things
the
that
Arkansas plan
have
seems
been,
to be.
have been looked at, and I think need to be carefully looked at, and we'll just see whether any of those get some real.
There was talk about expanding Insure Oklahoma.
Support.
There was a law that was that a bill that they were working on. I think that kind of fell apart, but maybe because they want to work on it
and just
a little bit better over the
politics at the Capitol on this deal. I mean, for the longest time. You know, ever since the Affordable Care Act passed, Obamacare passed, and the legislature and Governor Fallon just didn't want to do anything that had any sort of fingerprints of President Obama on it. They didn't want to endorse anything like that. But now we're at a point where, you know, the two champions of Medicaid expansion under the Arkansas plan in the legislature right now that have really worked tirelessly, two Republicans, and you know, they've really gone to bat on this. And so, I mean, I think that something's going to happen here, and it's just a matter of time. Now, as former Speaker Lewis in a blog post that he said, you know, what's another year? Well, if we get it done, you know, great. But for those folks that are struggling without health insurance right now, or if you're a rural hospital facing closure right now, that year can make all the difference.
Absolutely. But the other thing is, when we talk about another year, the backdrop of the 2020 presidential campaign and Democrats and how they have really the healthcare issue has been at the forefront of so many of their debates, how that will change the look and how Oklahomans will respond. I mean, to this notion of more of the nationalized or the socialized healthcare. I mean, those things I think we've seen have very little support here in Oklahoma, and that's where the politicizing of this particular issue can really, I think, compound of what we're talking about in terms of just the basic policy side.
There was this real test after the end of the last legislative session going into the election cycle of whether Republicans that voted for revenue-raising measures were going to be booted out in primaries, and really the opposite was true. It was the folks that stood in the way of those revenue-raising measures that lost their primaries. And so, you know, the two Republicans that I was talking about there, Senator Greg McCourtney and Representative Marcus McIntyre, I mean, they have done the lion's share of work of building support within the Republican caucus for this. I doubt that either one of them are going to be primaried out of existence because of their support for Medicaid expansion. And, you know, and even if nothing happens between now and the 2020 election cycle, those folks not getting beat on the issue of Medicaid expansion will begin to send a signal, I think, to other Republicans. People want something to happen here, and it's not a political liability that we used to think that it was.
Nominations by the governor had a bit of a hiccup last week, but this week they mostly sailed through without a problem. The full state Senate approved the nominations for former Senator Mike Mazey for budget secretary, as well as Estella Hernandez and Jennifer Moniz to the State Board of Ed. They were approved. Neva, what changed here?
I think we had a process that just moved forward, and as I think most expected, these nominees would be confirmed. I think the process in terms of these higher level appointees by the governor having more scrutiny by the Senate, having senators have the opportunity to hear more of their points of view in the areas that they're going to serve, such as education that we're talking about with Jennifer Moniz and Estela Hernandez. But at the end of it, they were party line votes. The only exception with Hernandez received one crossover Democrat senator voting for her. But it was strong, moved quickly out of the committee. Next day, the Senate confirmed these nominees. And as you say, I mean, Mike Massey was confirmed on a 47-1 vote this week in the Senate. So after all of the consternation and kind of the back and forth contention in one particular committee hearing, I think what we see, in my estimation, it mirrors much of what we see in the congressional hearings, where everyone gets an opportunity to vet the nominees, have their questions answered, and then the vote comes down, and oftentimes they are party line votes because of just the nature of the environment.
Right.
What a difference a week makes. Yeah. Senator Massey under the crossfire last week. I mean, they recessed it. It was just getting so out of hand. And we talked about this last week. It was really a proxy fight, I think, both for budget negotiations, but then also for this issue that over the next few years, as long as Stitt is in office, that we're going to begin to see. Because, you know, for the longest time, if you're a lawmaker, if you're a state legislator, you're used to picking up the phone and not just calling an agency head, but calling some, you know, department chief over an agency and saying, hey, I've got a question about the way this works. Can you tell me how this works? And can you tell me how this money is spent? Can you tell me how we should maybe do a better job here? And, you know, if you're one of those agency employees, there's always been kind of this question of, well, is the governor my boss? Is the agency chief, agency head my boss? Agency secretary my boss? Or do I report to this single legislator, even if that legislator is very powerful and the chairman of appropriations? And so there's this pool. And what we've seen is kind of this business approach from the Stitt administration of trying to, you know, consolidate areas of hierarchy, kind of like a organizational flowchart. It's like, you know, you don't report to the chairman of appropriations. You report to the agency head, and the agency head reports to me. And that's what that real fight really became about, was whether or not lawmakers were going to have that unfettered access to agencies. Now, we're being told, well, if you've got a problem getting this information, now you just call the governor's office, and Massey will, Senator Massey has said that he'll sort it out and get the answer for you. But we're going to see some turf wars over the next few years. Not necessarily a bad thing, but it's, you know, it's a healthy exercise of the separation of powers and the co-equal branches of government and figuring out who controls what.
University of Oklahoma President James Gallagly is leaving after 10 months on the job. Ryan, did the resignation announcement come as a surprise to you?
I think it came as a surprise to everyone. I mean, I saw a reporter tweet shortly after that said that he had talked to President Gallagly the week before and mentioned something about, you know, tenure or resignation. And he said, well, nothing further from the truth. And here he is. He's resigning. I think that no one looked at the appointment of President Gallagly as somebody who was going to serve a generation like his predecessor did. And I think that there was a lot of concern about who was going to step into this role to fill the shoes of President Boren, who his legacy, you know, now it's embattled at the university, but his legacy as a president of raising money, of, you know, raising the prestige of that university and investing in research and tech, I mean, all of the things that he did while he was president, those were big shoes to fill. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there was always a sense that whoever took that place was going to have to come in, and in this case, you know, do some really hard things. I mean, whether you agree with it or not, I think that there's some sense that he was hired as the guy to come in and clean things up, not be the most popular president in the university's history, you know, probably not going to have a prominent statue on the Oval somewhere, or if he does, you know, 10 years from now, people won't remember who that was. But, I mean, he did that job, and I think that he did the job that the regents probably hired him to do. Now the regents have a bigger job of selecting, you know, that next generational leader for the university, and they've recognized that they made mistakes that first round. I mean, Gallagly was a guy who was hired, he didn't even apply for the job. It was a very secretive process. You know, a lot of faculty weren't included. Students certainly didn't have a lot of voice in what was happening there. And the university community, if you're going to pick a generational leader, needs to be much more included in a very open process that I think includes a big search. They shouldn't just, you know, start to look within their ranks and hire somebody and say it's a done deal. They need to do a big search and bring in the right person for this job.
Neva.
Well, I agree. It needs to be a big search. And I think when you look back, though, at any presidential search, I mean, there's always the knock that there's never enough involvement by faculty and students and alumni and all of the different elements that come into that process that all care about who leads their alma mater, their university, the folks across the state at large. And so I think that it will be incumbent upon the regents to really take this into account and probably do a better job than ever before, because the scrutiny will be higher than ever before. But, you know, it's also interesting that the OU president had said just a few months ago that in an interview that I read that said that the job was much harder than he ever imagined, that he really he thought that this was was something to the effect that he thought it would be an easy job and that wouldn't require the hours that the long work hours that he had wound up putting into it for close to a year now. And I think he came in with such a difficult challenge because of the financial crisis that the university found itself in, that he really had to be the person at the helm to kind of move through this process. I think the other overarching element to this were the things that were happening on the campus, some of the racist concerns, mm-hmm. and some of the issues that came into play that became storylines that were very difficult, you know, always difficult to manage from an administration point of view, and trying to make sure that the right message goes out to the public on how they are trying to deal with that. So I think it's always a challenge for any university to, as you say, find that next generational leader. I mean, someone who can move the university forward in a big way, and it will be interesting to see not only what happens here, but what the impact now of this departure is on the investigation that is still ongoing, yeah. and would be significant in terms of who the president is, who ultimately could play a significant role in that final in how that finally is resolved.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a lot of anxiety on campus right now among faculty and staff, and I mean, we've had that, and so just, you know, having some steady hand there, and whenever that investigation information does come out, it's going to be incredibly important to have a good leader there to explain that to the people. A resignation that may be as important. Kelly Burley announced leaving KOSU as station manager. And so I want to just throw out it.
Of course, he's been here for
29 years. You talk about a generational leader who has watched an organization go from something to the amazing affiliate that it is right now at KOSU.
You know, but so, this was his idea.
Yeah. So
the This Week in Oklahoma Politics, Kelly Burley.
A big thank you to Kelly Burley for his service to KOSU.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you say that, also, when you talk about making this change, one of the real difficult parts of that is if you have a real lengthy selection process, we could be talking about 6 months a year. So, I mean, the idea of putting someone in place quickly is not very likely unless the regents come to some meeting of the minds, believe that they have a consensus candidate among themselves, and then they choose to move that person forward and see what the kind of the overall public reaction is to it. They certainly have the prerogative to do that, and they may feel the need to do that in the best interest of the university. We'll just have to wait and
hopefully
see.
Hopefully that'll just be interim, though.
Yeah, that would probably be interim there. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.